Darren Burrell.
And I'm your co-host, Patrick McIntyre.
We will explore the stories from our conscious collection of music, books, and film.
The ones that have shaped our lives.
Join us as we take a closer look at what remains. Welcome to Remainders, where we share stories from our conscious collection of movies, books, and film. The stories, the sounds, and the characters that stay with you long after they've returned to the shelves. Today we're talking about 2019's Nothing's Bad Luck by freelance journalist turned biographer C.M. Cushions. This is the story of Warren Zevon, the son of a gambling gangster with ties to Los Angeles mobster Mickey Cohen. Zevon is the man who idolized and possibly drank scotch underage with legendary composer Igor Stravinsky. He's the classical pianist who became a crucial band leader and session player with the Everly Brothers. Some folks fondly remember Warren simply as David Letterman's favorite guest and friend. Zevon was inarguably talented. He quickly became the most dangerous, gritty, raw, and sought-after songwriter of the late 1960s and beyond. His art often imitated his life and vice versa. He struggled with alcohol and drug addiction throughout his life and career. He was the raging alcoholic that managed his life the same way he managed his addictions and his career, on his own terms. A legendary poet whose dark and lonely lyrics often play out within the city of Los Angeles, providing a darker backdrop to the sun-soaked dreamer's paradise. Zevon gives the listener a glimpse into the seedy side of the city of angels while providing the cautionary tales of what happens when the transplant is rejected. Warren Zevon took us where we didn't want to go because his music hit way too close to home for some of us. His story is the story of substance. Substance as an artist and the substances he consumed. The substances that should have killed him way before his untimely death at the age of 56 from mesothelioma. This is the story of a man who solidified his place within the hearts of those of us who want to be told the truth no matter how scary it is when we look in the mirror. Those of us who want to relate to someone who reminds us of the extreme highs and eventual lows of behaving as an excitable boy. Warren Zevon's persistence to be himself, no matter the cost and no matter the latest trend, is why he has surpassed legendary status in our minds and in the minds and hearts of Zevonites all around the world. It is why we're talking about the man today. Warren Zevon will forever be more than Werewolves of London, and we can't wait to tell you why. Pat, welcome to Warren Zevon. I feel like this one is our whole friendship in making to tell this story together. And I'm excited to do this. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, man. That definitely set him up in my eyes. Legendary status is certainly how I view him. So thank you for that beautiful intro, because that captures a lot of what we're going to talk about and kind of how meaningful Warren Zevon has been to us. You know, we've shared this interest in this amazing singer-songwriter for many years now. And it's just one of the many reasons why we kind of wanted to talk about him on this.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, this book was brought to my attention by you. And so for all the listeners out there, the way that Pat had talked about it, this book on Warren Zevon was supposed to be the more quintessential, I suppose. There's been books written about him before, but it seemed to be one that spanned his whole career and the ups and downs, really. So I was excited to do it, and Pat graciously purchased the book for me, so thank you for that. And I loved it. The thing that struck me the most is right off the bat, when you open up the first page, there is an American folk tale that starts it off about the tale of sort of two lives being lived. And this American folk tale is the battle between two wolves inside everyone. One is evil and one is good. Of course, Warren Zevon being known mostly for the song Werewolves of London. But as you and I have talked about, even in this podcast before and other episodes, that Warren Zevon is way more than Werewolves of London. And the idea of there's two wolves inside of you, one that ultimately presents itself is the one that you feed. And there's one good and one that's evil. I think that starting this book off this way about a true pioneer in music and art couldn't have been more perfect. You know, he had choices that were very deliberate and unapologetic in his life. And early on, feeding that evil wolf, really, inside of him, and later feeding the good, I believe, having lived two lives, as the author states, you know, right at the beginning, and then brings it home at the end of this book that Warren really lived two full lives in only 56 years.
Yeah, that's definitely a great way to frame this whole conversation and him himself, is the good wolf and the bad wolf and which one you feed. And you certainly get a lot of that in this. I feel like, okay, so we're quite a bit younger than when Zevon was on the scene making music. So he came on first album 1969. So he was making music pretty early, and he was pretty prominent throughout the 70s and 80s. And he definitely had a very party persona, for sure, and a very conflicted persona. And I think that comes through beautifully with that opening of that book. Depending on which one you feed, I think that's part of the struggle that he faced throughout his entire life.
It's sort of like the battle of good and evil, and like,
right,
it's like conscious living in general. The one that you give your attention to is the one that's going to be on display. And that early times of his life, but he was very quickly, as I said at the beginning, looked at as a great songwriter. Everybody thought that. He was working with Jackson Browne. So he was kind of all around. People knew him. And you talk about it at times, Pat, like as a musician's musician. He was looked at like that. So for him to kind of go off and do his solo thing, I don't think that was originally the idea. I think it was to be a sort of a songwriter hanging out here in Los Angeles and just being kind of a badass. You know, they talk about him being in the Hollywood Hills partying really hard in those early days. Through those kind of connections and things like that, he became really well known. And I think chapter one opens up really nicely with the idea of song noir. I had never heard that term before, but I related to that. I think the way that I write is song noir. It's always kind of self-loathing, you know, dark, and kind of exploring the things that aren't really happy. We talked about this on the Daniel Johnson episode where, I don't know, when I'm happy, I don't really have much to sing about. It's certainly Zevon's stuff, and even the titles of his records were very dark. Always, death always loomed around, which is so, I guess, interesting for his life story to know that he died so early. He almost kind of manifested that destiny for himself by the way he lived it.
Upon the release of Excitable Boy, Chip Engelman, he described Zevon's music as a cross between Clint Eastwood and Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
That's amazing.
Yes. I take it a step back. You know, Zevon is not, you know, he's still not a very well-known musician. How would you say that's accurate? I mean, other than the song.
For sure.
Yeah, other than Werewolves of London, people knowing that. I don't think most people, you know, I don't think most people who are listening to the podcast are going to really know like a full set of songs from Zevon besides that one. Would you say that's accurate?
I think that's very accurate. And I wanted to say, he did not wish to make that perfect pop package. True artists like Zevon wrote songs about the rest of us and the ugly truths we're afraid to acknowledge almost. And he put those on a platform. Now, I'm not saying that he didn't have some pop mentality stuff going in through his songwriting and the way some of his melodies went and verse, chorus, and those kind of setups. But he wasn't really writing these songs for the masses, and maybe that's part of it. But I don't think that would have been good for that style of writing, for song noir. It wasn't him, and it makes him a legend. And that's why, again, why we're talking about him now and why the music lives, is because it has depth. It has something to say, and it has relatability to people who are eventually going to hit a little bit of rock bottom in their lives.
Zevon has always been one of my favorite musicians. I had a pretty progressive family in terms of music and books. Most of our family gatherings were revolved around trading albums, CDs, and books to each other. And at a pretty young age, I was turned on to a couple albums by Zevon because my father and uncle both were huge fans of him. So I kind of had an early exposure to him. And that definitely kind of shaped my understanding of him, because he had such a unique style. But also, my discovery of him was kind of like around the same time that I discovered punk. You know, I think I probably listened to the Ramones and Warren Zevon within like the same couple of months for the first time.
Well, I don't think anybody would argue that Warren Zevon was a punk.
That's kind of what I was thinking, because like his persona is certainly that outlaw aspect, that that fuck you aspect. I mean, his life was certainly a fuck you to the things he wasn't down with. He was very cynical, and that is infused in all of his lyrics. But I think he has a very punk aesthetic to the structure of his songs, even though when you listen to the music, there's like, you know, nothing punk about it.
I think in chapter one, they also talk about his father's ties to organized crime, and the fact that Zevon was sort of like Bugsy Siegel. Bugsy Siegel was more of like the Hollywood gangster, right? Being a son of a famous gangster, I think he kept those dark corners, but strived for notoriety and lights that only Los Angeles could bring him. So that sort of duality is right there within his upbringing as well.
Yeah, so he was born actually here in Chicago. I actually didn't know, which was fantastic to learn. Grew up in L.A., as you said, his father was a Russian gangster, Russian mobster. He's a tough motherfucker, gambler. And I love that Warren's first musical instrument was one in a card game that his father played. So his father was out wheeling and dealing, playing cards, and ended up winning a piano. He ends up giving it to Warren, and this is his initial exposure to creating music.
That whole upbringing was going to bring on some bad things and some bad tendencies within the son, and that's kind of when we get into talking about his struggles with addiction early on and alcohol and parties. And when you're younger and you're doing that kind of stuff around a bunch of famous people, it's fun. And he has the song Excitable Boy about all these crazy things that, you know, partying and things like that. But really, it started, I think, from an early age. I think you said something earlier about him starting drinking at like 12 or something. It was a pretty early start for Warren Zevon.
He did experience abuse at the hand of his father. There was certainly rampant alcoholism in his home at a young age, and he, as you just said, he started drinking at around 12. It's not really something he talked about or wrote about too much later in life, but I think it's infused in his lyrics. And it manifested in a variety of ways, but like I think it mostly came out as two things: using music as an escape, but also that lifelong addiction to alcohol and drugs.
Right. It's almost like the escape that you can't escape, because that lifestyle just brings it on even more, right? And I hope I'm not jumping too forward here, but I think alcohol addiction is such a big part of this story.
Absolutely.
There's this quote that I wanted to talk about and sort of how I can relate to it, and possibly you as well. In chapter 4, it says, "When an alcoholic discovers that people care for him, his whole way of thinking is threatened. Either you try to return that love by taking care of yourself, or you keep drinking and spend your life being insulated from the rest of the world."
Yeah.
That's Warren Zevon's quote himself from the book. And what he's saying here to me is that a lot of people try to help you through something when they see you struggling. And you can either accept that help and say, okay, I'm going to return the love and care that I've given by actually being present in trying to fix my problem that I have and acknowledging it. Or you shun it away from the people that care about you most. You shun it away and you just keep on going down that path, maybe sometimes even harder, and really trying to be, as he put it, insulated from the rest of the world. Like, you kind of have to go into your own seclusion, because the fear is these people that you care about, that you love, you truly do, they're going to have eyes on you from that moment on and always be judging you. And you just don't want those watchful, judgeful eyes on you. So you insulate yourself from the rest of the world. And once you get into that place in the drinking arena, it's kind of the start of a problem, in my opinion. You know, when you start realizing I can't be around people that I love and care about because it's been acknowledged that I have a problem.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I think that sums up a struggle for a lot of people. I mean, I've definitely identified with that kind of general feeling with my own drinking and the way I've been able to fortunately step away from it. But I have many glimpses of just kind of the perception that I would give out to people if I felt like I was drinking too much.
This is another quote. "The scariest part about alcoholism, about any addiction for that matter, is that you credit the booze for all your accomplishments. In your younger years," I can relate to this. Man, I was so drunk when I wrote that. The whole TLB first album was written when I was completely smashed, hammered, fully. And I think that's one of the best records I've ever written. Now, I'm conscious enough to know that that's not because of the booze, but I also know that I've just romanticized it because of the booze, right? That's part of what we do, especially in artists, that you look at these dangerous things, or because, again, you hear about the stories of Scott Fitzgerald, this legendary booze hound, and all of those legendary writers, and some of their best works were written when they were having addiction problems. We're even doing that right now, talking about Warren Zevon, you know? I mean, all those early records and all these great things is when he was going through the throes of it all. So I really loved that quote. Again, I believe that was Zevon who said that as well. Being very conscious of what was happening. You know, it's a very smart man. Warren Zevon was a very smart man.
Even to a small degree, do you feel like any type of drugs or alcohol do assist in the creative process?
It becomes something to relax you enough to take your inhibitions out of it. But if you are smart enough or strong enough to be able to do that without the alcohol, then I think it doesn't matter. But I think if you are somebody who needs that to open yourself up because of whatever fears you have, then there's no doubt it helps, because it's, I guess, the liquid courage, as people call it, right?
I'm just more curious on kind of like a performance aspect, you know, not necessarily you recording, but you on stage.
They talk about that Roxy stuff that he recorded for Zevon, speaking of Zevon, for his first live record, of him being just the wildest man on stage because he was so shit-canned. But I never had any of that success in my career. Whenever I'd get drunk, I would fall down and I would hurt myself, and literally that would be the end of the show. I was never very good on booze live. When I abstained from it, I was wilder than I was on liquor. I could just stand up straighter.
Yeah, I mean, because I think about it a lot. So, I mean, I'm never, like, on stage before. I'm just not a musician. But so, like, that album you just mentioned, Stand in the Fire, it's his live album from 1981. I think it's one of his best albums. It's up there with Excitable Boy, but it's certainly one of my favorite live albums of all time. And as we learn in this, he was extremely deep into alcohol, consuming a mass amount of it, and drugs at the time. You hear from all the musicians that he was playing with at the time that he was incredibly composed on stage. He was always doing everything you needed as a musician to perform. And then it comes out as one of his best records, I think. So that's why it just kept on. I mean, if I'm convinced of it, I can't even fathom like how much he probably convinced himself that he needed the alcohol. And that's why it was so difficult for him to step away from it for so long.
Well, and he worked his ass off. I mean, there's no doubt about that, the way his work ethic went. And something else in Chapter 5 that I wrote down here that I related to, and I don't know if you've ever related to this, Pat, but if you have, please chime in, because sometimes I feel like people think I'm joking when I talk about this. Night terrors, and they talk about Warren having night terrors as a withdrawal process from alcohol. Sleep paralysis being, I think, the term that I've heard most is what it is, and they talk about Warren hurling himself against the wall to kind of wake himself up from it. But sleep paralysis, for anybody who doesn't know, is like when you're sort of in that limbo. It happens to people, from what I've read, where you're either a workaholic and you get so tired that you become like in between state of like, you can't really hit that REM state. And so you're kind of consciously awake, but can't move. So you're sleeping, but you're like consciously aware of your surroundings. And it also happens to alcoholics. Mm. So I definitely took note of this here, because it happened to me a lot in my heavy drinking days. And also, I think it coupled with the fact that I work really hard a lot when I'm in on something, I don't give up. So both of those things were happening to me. And what happens in sleep paralysis, which a lot of people don't know, is that you are literally conscious and you know you should be waking up, but you can't move your hands or any of your extremities. But your mind is coherent. A lot of times what happens is you're in this dreamlike state, even though it's very real, and you see things that are super scary, like old hag, witch-looking women at the foot of your bed and shit like that. Like, I'm literally pretty sure that sleep paralysis is talked about in why like Salem witch trial stuff happened, because there was like a lot of people that thought they saw this kind of stuff and were like, oh, my neighbor was a witch and she came over and she did this. But like, it's not just sitting there at the end of the bed. Like, the way you wake up sometimes is by that entity, whatever you're seeing that's scaring you, like running at you and holding you down. Like it's holding your soul down. And I don't never really talked about this much, but when they talked about it in the book, I could relate so easily to it. It's very scary to experience. And if there's anybody out there that has experienced it, I'd love to hear your comments about it and your experiences, because I think it's pretty similar for everybody who goes through it.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Me personally, I haven't experienced anything like that. When I stepped away from alcohol, my sleeping, it was like a switch. It just became substantially better. So fortunately, it wasn't an obstacle that I faced, but yeah.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the thing, right? It's like every night I go to bed, I hug my bed. I'm like, this is the best thing in the world. Like, you just love it so much because you just forgot about how great it is. Chapter 6. And in discussing the tour for the Envoy is where he showed up solo on his tours for the album cycle, right? Where he's kind of having to do things at a lower budget. The days of him having the hit songs are a little behind him. And he's kind of, it didn't seem like in the book, at least, he very much complained about it. And again, that's like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I'm going to write the songs that I want to do. And to be damned with the trends. Like if that, at that time, you know, Warren Zevon was told by a record label that he needed to do TikTok, he would have told them to go fuck themselves. You know, he was just the guy who just did what he wanted to do. And that, to me, is what makes you a legend. You didn't follow the trends. And even though the guy had to do all these solo, driving his own van a lot of times and different things like that when things were really bad, he didn't care. That was what he had to do, because he wasn't going to go the route of like giving in to writing something that wasn't true. And we love that. We love him for that. It says a lot about where he was at that time in his career and the beginning of his real slip from the spotlight. His alcohol addiction had its hold on him, and you know, the girlfriends, he looked at them to take care of him, because a lot of times, especially around that time, he was dating Kim Lankford and she was on the way out. Around this time, Warren kind of disappeared to Philadelphia so he could be away from prying eyes of people in LA that cared for him and that knew this guy is in trouble. He started to sever all the ties in his life of people that cared about him, because he just was a raging alcoholic and drug addict. In chapter 7, Anita Gevinson, who was his girlfriend at the time, said, "I don't throw the word genius around easily, but I know now that each have that one demon they have to fight. The one that tries to keep them from their talent." There's so much truth behind that. Every single artist, whether it's alcohol addiction or something else, has that one thing that holds them back. It's like a fight, a constant fight. And alcohol is a big part of that for Warren Zevon and his life story, is that it's really trying so hard. That addiction, that disease is trying to stop Warren Zevon from being a singer-songwriter that inspires people out there with his songwriting.
Yeah, I mean, I was definitely thinking about that in terms of him being in, just being a rock and roll icon, a rock and roll figure, and the culture that comes around it, where drinking excessively is often only the beginning of the night. The same for a lot of people. Drinking is so consuming because you drink when you're up and you drink when you're down. Something shitty happens, you drink. Something great happens, you also drink. And for me, that was kind of the problem, and I definitely saw that as a recurring theme with Zevon, and this jumping ahead a little bit to his sobriety, once he does step away from alcohol and he has an album that doesn't perform as well, he reacts in a positive way, whereas a couple of his albums had flopped and he went into like a year-long binge of drinking.
Right.
That was his reaction while he was drinking. And then when he wasn't, an album didn't do that well, he basically turned it into his advantage, actually. So
I think this is what you're saying about the acceptance of the fact that he had at this time an album that wasn't doing so well. In the past, he would have went on a year-long binge and wasted a year of his life drinking it away and probably pouting about it. Instead, this time he turned it into a positive. And that's something that you really become clear on if you do the work in figuring out, you know, what alcohol does to you. Like, that's a big part of the Philadelphia part that I talked about, too, moving there. Another quote is, Anita Gevison says, like all addicts, he became adept to hiding his disease from anyone who might care. It's so true. It's just another strong quote about the fact that when you have a real bad problem and you start to hide it from people that care about you, you're hiding it from them because you know that they know. And you really deep down know you need some help, but you don't want to give it up. It's a disease.
That's also the fear of what exposing the problem will cause you to lose. You know, you hide it from people you love because you may fear that your addiction or your struggles may actually hurt them and you may lose them.
Yeah, he needed alcohol so much that he moved to a private island. Just to get a little understanding to our listeners out there of how deep this went, it started to affect his children, who he didn't even see a lot of in the first place. But when they would come over, there's another quote from his girlfriend at the time, Anita Gevinson, who says, Ariel Zevon would draw, and exploring the hardships between Warren and his children in the book, they talk about the division that alcohol placed on their relationship, Warren's relationship with the kids. And the quote is, what makes a little girl draw pictures of a sky raining on her home? Those were the kind of drawings she was drawing at the time, of her in the window of a sky over the house dumping rain on them. That's a terrible way to grow up with a father that's just completely drunk all the time.
You really get a sense that he loved his children, but he was certainly not in any position to be a caring father, and especially not like a day-to-day attentive parent at all.
I think it's good to point out, as most of these people that we talk about that we do really look up to, we definitely acknowledge the flaws in people like this. Like Warren Zevon had to go through these kind of things to come out the other side, but we all do. Not everybody is perfect. I think it's important for us to say that he, at this point in the book, he's not a great father at all.
You never want to meet your idols, because you're going to be disappointed.
Right. He got asked to be on some TV shows, which brought out a lot of that Warren Zevon character we talked about earlier. And Kathy Griffin had this quote in the book about it. Suddenly Susan was the show that she was on, and he had done a cameo. And she said, I wondered if this was one of those situations where four other well-known musicians turned down the gig and we ended up with someone truly great.
Yeah. That's
I
great.
Love that for so many reasons, because of course he was great, because of course he was. But the first thing that people at that time in his career would say, I'm Warren Zevon. Who knows Warren Zevon anymore? You know, like, let's try to get somebody else. And so they try for Bruce Springsteen, or they try for somebody else of that era, and they couldn't get him. So they end up getting Zevon, and lo and behold, he's the Warren Zevon you always knew was kick-ass.
According to the charts, he was not on the A-team, but in terms of songwriting and musical talent, he was certainly on the A-team.
Yeah, and he definitely had people that looked up to him. Your whole point about a musician's musician, I think, is the biggest thing to bring out in his later career, and maybe what kept him going, because, of course, people wanted to put out his music. Somehow, I think it was through a manager, infused himself with the members of REM before they really took off. And so they had a band that I didn't even know about called Hindu Love Gods, which is kind of a secret out there. Yeah. And you can listen to that music. I've never actually listened to it, so I'm looking forward to digging into that.
I've actually only heard one song. There was one song from the Hindu Love Gods on an early best of Zevon, and it was a cover of, I know this may sound weird, it was a cover of Prince's Raspberry Beret, which is unexpected, I guess, but it turns out really well. It's actually a pretty solid cover.
Oh man, I can see it like kind of nasally Zevon, like, what?
Yeah.
But yeah, because they talk about that in the book, that he would perform that actually a lot. Yeah, so they, you know, a lot of the musicians that would come back for every time he would record, it would kind of be like a getting the gang back together, even though they kind of looked at Zevon as his career might be a little bit over, and he could still write a great song, but the people, the public, had stopped coming to the shows, and he would have to do them mostly alone.
Which I get is so frustrating. I can only imagine it's so frustrating, because, as we mentioned, he was adored by like so many musicians, Bruce Springsteen, the Everly Brothers, the Eagles. I mean, just everybody who worked around his circle like put him on a pedestal in terms of musical ability. All of his albums are extremely well received by critics when they come out. It's not even like just in retrospect. And yet he really never has any even close to like charting albums. Excitable Boy, because of Werewolves in London, is by far his most successful, and even that is like a medium sized hit. But every one of his other albums, you know, comes pretty close to flopping. And again, like we were mentioning, it has a major effect on him throughout his life.
When you have a hit song, it's like some people might look at it from a third person type of view, like, oh god, it must suck to have to play that song all the time. And we even say Warren Zevon more than Werewolves of London, but he liked that he was able to have that in his repertoire, and so do other musicians. I think that that's if you have a hit, you like playing it because you know people enjoy it. That's the point.
Yeah. No doubt. He definitely expressed no reservations in wanting to include Werewolves of London in sets that lasted the rest of his life, which is awesome.
He only showed reservation of it being a single before it became a hit, and then once it became a hit, he didn't talk about it anymore, about any kind of reservations behind it. A hit is a hit.
Well, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about that, because they go into the struggles throughout the album productions for almost all of his albums in terms of choosing the right singles. And with such a unique artist like Warren, where he has incredible music, but it's not always the most like recognizable in terms of pop structure or what's going to be the most catchy on the radio. And so there was always an internal battle between him and the record companies in terms of choosing like which singles to push, if at all. And maybe I just kind of wanted to pick your brain, like for your music, like how do you decide on kind of the quote best songs that you think are going to be the most popular?
Yeah, so I guess I'd be in like the team of I'm not great at that, and I would expect some business people who seemingly know what they're doing to tell me, because I'm always the guy who doesn't have I only look at set lists when I go and perform as where is my voice going to hold out the best, and where is it going to hold out, you know, where is it that I need a break in the set. I don't look at it in terms of the audience, and that's not good, but it's the way that I can perform things. And so I also look at that as the way that like my instinctual favorite song on a record is going to be the single. Other people that I know, like Tom, you know, in our band and everything, he's just had so much experience with it of knowing like what's going to connect with an audience, what's going to be something that has the best chance of life out there. Because, you know, it's got to be on. They talk about Zevon coming up in the whole MTV, you know, world, and needing to have a song that would fit to that generation. Let's just talk about the audience. You know, for TLB, when we picked Holiday, it was perfect because we were in the middle of a pandemic. For our record to have that as like the real big single we wanted to push, it just made sense. The chorus is, let's get away for a holiday. We can party all night and drink our pain away. We'll forget about yesterday. This weekend we can have a holiday. And perfect to put that out during a pandemic where everybody's locked inside and just want to go on a holiday and get fucked up, you know. I pick from deep in the heart, and that might not be the best for business, so maybe that's where Zevon was coming from.
Well, I remember vividly the first time I heard Drinks on Me and suggesting to you that should be the first single. So that's just me, yeah. As a friend or a fan or both. That's what I was suggesting. So
totally. And I think one of the people definitely relate to too. Again, it's like relatability with that kind of stuff goes a long way, where Zevon always kind of seems to have these little personal ditties that you really have to be in a kind of a darker place to really connect to it, you know?
Zevon is such a literary figure. He was obsessed with books. He was obsessed with writers. He surrounded himself with writers at all opportunities. He infamously had a collection of over 3,000 books when he passed away. And actually did a little research. Up until a couple years ago, there was a couple books on eBay from his collection that were still on sale. Like his original copies from his collection. A lot of them obviously like dedicated to Zevon, because again, he was a famous figure who loved writers. So he was constantly hanging out with writers. I mean, Hunter S. Thompson was one of his closer friends. And it just says a lot about how he wrote music. You know, it was poetry in the form of music, and unfortunately, you know, that just doesn't always translate into something accessible for the radio.
Well, here's the quote in chapter 12 that I guess he's paraphrasing from another writer, but We love to buy books because we believe we're buying the time to read them. How about that?
That quote blew me away as somebody who buys books all the time. It definitely made me analyze my every time I do buy a book.
Well, think about when you talk about being a literary figure, like, what does that mean? And crafting songs that hit you so hard and you don't even know why, it's because of the wordplay and the poetry that's within them. And so talking about Desperados Under the Eaves, I was just talking about this morning when I was listening to it. California slips into the ocean, like the mystics and statistics say it will. Mm. And then he says, but this motel will still be standing until I pay my bill. Like, that's the poetry you're talking about. Because it's such a big thing to wrap your head around. California, the state itself, could go into the ocean and drown and be done with, yet my bill that I have to pay would still be here, and I can't catch a break. That's how big that is. I mean, that's genius. That's brilliance. And that's real writing, if you ask me.
Yeah. It goes into the couple times that he ducked out on the bill because he was too drunk to even know he had one.
Well, they talked about Desperados Under the Eaves, I think, having to do with a real life story where he literally did have to walk out in the back window and jump into a friend's.
Yeah, that's absolutely what it is. And it's a big reason why it's one of his best songs, for sure.
Yeah. And the other lyrics in there, like, you know, don't the sun look angry at me? That song is like a total song about having a hangover. And the way he's even descriptive about the city of Los Angeles in there, all the salty margaritas in Los Angeles, I'm going to drink them up. Like, he says that after the line about, I'm going to have to pay my bill, which he can't obviously do. So he's basically saying, fuck it, I'm going to go get drunk. And then the end of that song is so goddamn beautiful. And he's like talking about the AC. And it's, you can almost picture him laying in bed where he's probably got all the shades drawn. It's the daytime. There's people swirling around outside doing everything that they do, walking around. The sunlight is going. It's Los Angeles. It's beautiful. You know, the ocean's probably right outside the window. But he's so hungover that all he can do is listen to that buzzing of the AC as it goes on. And then he sings throughout the end of the song into the fade out. He sings about what that sound is as he's laying there in this beautiful sort of fade out. And I just, man, I could not love that more.
Definitely one of the more beautiful songs he's ever written, especially that outro that you just described.
Yeah, man. I can hear it in my head right now as I said it. And it's like, I want to tell you to get lost so I can listen to the song.
He originally wanted to be a classical composer. You know, I loved finding out about his adoration for classical music. And that's what he was originally saw himself when he started creating music when he was younger. Even after his first album, he still thought he was going to continue on to a more classical route. Him coming from a literary background and then applying poetry to the music, it reminded me a lot of Lou Reed, to be honest.
Yeah.
Who also had those types of aspirations, and it's just I just saw a lot of parallels between that, and it was very inspiring.
I like the way that towards the end of his life, as a guy who's seen some shit, right? This line that he says to Danny Goldberg, who was the CEO of his last record label, Artemis. This quote just says a lot about Warren Zevon and who he was by the time he passed away. He said, I'm so happy that the belief you had in me is paying off for you. I'm just so unselfish. And
wow, that's incredible.
Thank you for believing in me, because if it did anything for you, well, then it did its job. You know, I love that.
Later in life, he definitely reflects a lot upon the damage that he did to his friends and family. You know, as you mentioned, he got to the point where he basically had to cut everybody out of his life. That is something that stayed with him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, the cerebral nature of Warren Zevon was not good for business or for the career in the short term. Mm-hmm. I think we've talked about that throughout this episode. Only in death were the masses now realizing how much they were going to miss this true pioneer and the stature of this man. Someone who wouldn't follow a trend to sell an album. A true artist who stuck to his own script. I mean, VH1 basically laughed and said, we'll never have Warren Zevon on this, until they found out he was dying and that they could possibly make a, you know, little documentary about him, and then they were interested. They talk about Zevon being the true professional, where he's like, hey, if that's going to further the reach of my last album and the understanding of my fans that I truly want to do this for them, then I'll do it, no matter what.
In 2002, he's diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer, and he knows he only has X amount of months to live. It's incredible following the trajectory of his life and what he talked about, which is primarily death, what he sang about, which is primarily death and violence and cynicism in life. And then for him to actually react to this information in the very similar way to the characters in his story, which is just, fuck you, I'm going to make the best possible album that I can possibly make. You know, the cancer may take my life away, but it's not, as long as I'm alive, it's not going to take my ability to make music away.
Having 17 years of sobriety up until this point, and as I talked about at the beginning, he led his life and his career how he wanted. And at the end of this life, he said, I want to start drinking again. Fuck it. And Billy Bob Thornton, being his next door neighbor, every once in a while had to have him over for a couple sessions towards those last years, or that last year of his life when he was making The Wind, which is his final album. And Billy Bob Thornton says, yeah, at one point he was taking his methadone and mixing it in with a $500 bottle of scotch. So Zevon, after 17 years, says, fuck it. I'm dying. I'm going to go and drink. However, I thought it was so beautiful in that one passage where there people are starting to worry, like, okay, yeah, he is going to die. He's got mesothelioma, which is brought on by exposure to asbestos, from the best of my knowledge, and it's nothing that he could cure. So he decides to say, fuck it. But there is a line, and I'm not quoting verbatim, where his girlfriend came over, and he goes, look underneath the bed. And all of the alcohol bottles that he had hidden under there were gone. And he said, I'm not going to go to God. I worked too hard not to go to God, not as a sober man.
We responded a lot to that fuck you that he gave, like, near, when he found out and he started drinking again. But then stepping away from that again within that short period of time, it shows that he saw the benefits of living a life without alcohol and how much it was able to let him live a better life.
And I think you and I have talked about it too. You know, each journey with that is your own. It's all individual. You can start drinking and stop and then decide you can just have one, or, you know, continue full on again. It's really everybody's own journey, and however they want to do it, you can't really judge anybody. So I definitely don't judge Warren Zevon for wanting to drink his self silly, finding out he was going to die after 17 years. In fact, I think it's just part of his story of a true individual.
I mean, I certainly saw it as him basically choosing. It's like, yeah, I'm going to die either way, so I may as well be sober to make sure that I can make the best possible album that I can.
Yeah.
Which he certainly does. I love his quote at the end of his life. If you're lucky, you do something special early in life and something special just before you die.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of a very insightful, I mean, talking from a unique position that he's in, that's a way of kind of contextualizing his work and his output and his reach and his artistic ability.
Well, one of the things I think that's most important to say is that while he did start drinking again after 17 years when he was diagnosed with mesothelioma and he's at the end of his life, he did stop again. And the reason being, from what they say, is that he realized his daughter Ariel was going to have a baby, and he wanted to be able to see that baby being born. And again, right up until the end, struggling with addiction. Even after 17 yeah. years of not drinking, that goes to show you what kind of disease that is. There's a lot to talk about with Warren Zevon. I'm sure this is going to end up being our longest episode, and I'm glad for that, because I think, man, reading this book, if anybody out there, I truly think that you should. And I just want to talk about patience for a second here, and the fact that being happy and conscious of how you're living and how you're working and how you're being rewarded from that work is so important, especially to the legacy, if you care about that at all, about your life and where it ends up going. Because again, I could say this a million times, but this quote says it the best. Most people aren't smart enough for Warren Zevon. They want what's cerebral. They want what's catchy. And to me, that's a quote by Dave Barry in the book, and it solidifies a lot of truths for me. Number one, following trends is career suicide. Number two, imitation is suicide. And number three, joining up on the next American Idol or the next TikTok or social media app that's a flash in the pan is merely a shortcut that will manifest a mediocre career. And people don't see that because they're not smart like Warren Zevon. Warren Zevon, I don't think, was even thinking about his legendary career. He just was that good and that real that he was going to be a legend because of the choices that he made. And again, I think that our world right now and the way we consume things and the way people think they need to, people are so worried about the work that goes into presenting the work that they do than actually giving any true attention to the main thing you want to say or the main work of art that you're doing. I guess the main things is what I said. Stick to your guns. Don't try to follow any trend. Be an individual. Be somebody who has something to say and say it loud and proud and don't apologize for it.
How do you think Zevon would have reacted to Instagram and Twitter?
Yeah, I think it would have had somebody do it for him if he felt that he needed to do it. But, you know, like right now, think about it. I looked on there. There's not even anything to continue the man's legacy. Like, you see Liz Taylor has her own legacy account. Marlon Brando does.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Prince has his own legacy. People to curate that for God knows how long. But mostly the work speaks for itself.
I guess I meant more he would have scoffed at it. But, I mean, he does have a little bit. His son, Jordan Zevon, posts quite a bit about his legacy. And then I've seen a couple other ones. So there's definitely some appreciation on there, which is nice to see.
Yeah, and I want, you know, this episode, I wanted to keep it a little bit more organic because we're also talking about something that you and I both have experienced and have just recently made some real life changes. Me being 1 year, today I'm 1 year sober. And I didn't pick the date, Pat. I didn't pick the date because of that. It just happened to fall on that date. Isn't that crazy?
That's
like the day we're talking about Warren Zevon.
That's beautiful. Congratulations, by the way.
Thanks for the help. You're a big part of why I was able to continue this long. And we've talked so much about the fact that I don't really want to continue to not drink my whole life, but I wanted to make sure that I understood what it was doing to me, what alcohol was doing to me, and I want to control it and not it control me. It is nice to look back on a year and think to a year ago when I didn't think it was possible
yeah.
to go a year without drinking, but I'm here to tell everybody who's listening, it really is so easy if you want it. You just really have to do the work and look inside and say, what's happening here? Why is this such an affliction in my life? Or why do I want to get some kind of help? And then those answers will come to you. You just have to ask about it.
That's great. I'd love to hear that. The stars almost aligned. Do you know what 2 days ago it was?
It's his birthday.
You know what happened? Oh, okay. There would have been a nice trifecta right there then.
Totally. But it's also kind of important for me to be in Los Angeles right now to like experience. I'm pretty close. Like, he spent a lot of his life living where I'm actually staying right now. So to kind of feel his presence around and what this, when I was drinking, I went to a lot of those CD bars here in Los Angeles, you know, and what those were like. So it's good to kind of feel that presence. He's still very much present here in this city.
I was going to say, reading through this, I was a little jealous. Like, these are all areas that Darren is living amongst right now and getting to explore.
Yeah.
I mean, limited exploration under a pandemic right now. But
right.
Getting to get the vibe of Zevon in his hometown.
Do you even talking earlier about Desperados Under the Eaves, like just to be in the apartment that I'm in right now and it being dated back to pretty much that time? Like, a lot of this area is dated back to those days of Zevon turn of the century stuff. So, you know, that Los Angeles was still pretty new at that time for him. And it hasn't changed much from that time period. It's kind of why I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood didn't really need to do too much to change its appearance. You just feel him walking around and it almost makes you get choked up. You know, I got choked up a lot of times reading this book, just thinking about the man living and creating art and thinking about my own life and the steps that I'm taking to kind of battle my own struggles, to live a good life, to want that.
That's why we're talking about these awesome figures that we love, because we get to learn from them and through their past experiences.
So there's one thing before we end. I just wanted to talk a little bit about one other song that I think is truly Los Angeles, and that's that French Inhaler song. You like that song? That's probably my favorite Warren Zevon song.
So you're obviously a huge fan of his first album, because those most of the ones you've mentioned are off his debut.
Yeah, that's right, I am. And the, you know, obviously Splendid Isolation is a huge favorite for me. That's on one of his later albums, of course. Splendid Isolation is, again, something I can relate to.
You sent that to me basically right when we went on lockdown. So I think that's the unofficial song of the pandemic of 2020.
Shit, man, I can't believe that I did that. I don't even remember it. Must have been when I was still drinking.
Nope.
I was actually sober. But yeah, like, I kind of love that, you know, being okay with that, kind of like you're bothered so much in life by certain things that when you finally have that, like, embrace it. And I like that song for that. But the French Inhaler, when I talk about the seedy Los Angeles kind of thing, it's, he's talking about, like, this woman. He even says at some point, like, I thought you'd be a star, so I drank up all the money. Basically thought I had my meal ticket within this woman who came here to follow her dreams and become this, like, amazing person. And he's just this lowlife who's kind of sucking off of her, eventually sucks her so dry that she has to say, "So long, Norman." Like, that's the end of the song. She's saying goodbye to him because this city spit her out. She couldn't make it. And he's kind of he's telling the story from the perspective, at least in my opinion, of this lowlife who sort of took advantage of this woman who came through and tried to make it, you know. And he even says, like, your face looks like something death brought over in his suitcase. Your pretty face is so wasted. Another pretty face devastated. Holy shit.
I didn't want to say it reminded me of TLB songs a little bit, but it kind of did.
Yeah. Well, it's just like the idea that you could see this man being up to no good, ruining lives. And that's kind of what happens here to wide-eyed, starry-eyed dreamers who come in with no understanding of what this town really could do to you.
It's an absolute classic of 70s singer-songwriters summing up those seedy areas and seedy people and just kind of the oftentimes tragic but sometimes beautiful stories that came out of it. What are your, like, just off the top of your head, what are your three favorite Zevon songs?
French Inhaler, Desperados Under the Eaves, probably Splendid Isolation.
Okay.
Some honorable mentions, Excitable Boy, I love, of course. It's funny, those are the ones, Excitable Boy or, like, Werewolves of London, which seemingly are more pop hits as far as just the candor of them, the way that they are presented. They're not my, like, favorite things in the world. I mean, like, Boom Boom Mancini is, like, always shocking whenever that comes on.
Yeah.
And there's different ones like that I enjoy, but I don't want to listen to, like, on repeat, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
How about you?
I mean, Rollin' the Headless Thompson Gunner is definitely my favorite song that he's ever written. It's an amazing example of storytelling in a short little song about this war rebel who is killed in battle, and then Warren's own sardonic and cynical storytelling vibe. He tells about this ghost that comes back and gets revenge. And that's just a song that's always stayed with me. But Lawyers, Guns, and Money, I think, is an... I feel like that's a song that we can just, like, nominate as, like, if we were going to go 200 years in the future to be, like, what America is. Try to describe what America is to people who are unfamiliar with it. Lawyers, Guns, and Money is an absolute ditty of what our country represents in the most cynical way.
And also, just to say one more side about that song, and I know I've talked to you about this before, and Jordan Zevon, if you're listening to this ever, I just want to say this moment was so beautiful on Letterman when you guys did Enjoy Every Sandwich and you performed it with the Wallflowers. Man, that moment when he says, well, they perform Lawyers, Guns, and Money on Letterman, and it's the moment where they go to Jordan. The only thing that he sings is, "Dad, get me out of this." Ha! It's like I start bawling, crying every time that part comes up, man, because it's so that's so poetic, right? He's singing about his dad, and he gets to say that. Yeah, that's his little moment, you know, and it was beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic fucking song. Send Lawyers, Guns, and Money. Dad, get me out of this. And seeing that perform with the two of them is incredible. I love it.
And just the relationship with Zevon and his idol, Bob Dylan, to see their sons performing that together was beautiful. On one of Warren Zevon's best friends being David Letterman's show.
Yeah, I mean, I loved hearing about, so later in life, again, he was always very popular among musicians, but later his songs were covered by Bob Dylan, like multiple ones, Mutineer, Lawyers, Guns and Money, Accidentally Like a Martyr, and Bob Dylan was a god to Warren Zevon, and his quote basically when he was finding out how much Dylan was performing his songs was, maybe this was worth it, you know, his terminal cancer.
Right, yeah, that was great. That's, and again, so Zevon to say that, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, one question I want to ask you before we get going, and I think this is important because I talked about, we had started this conversation before we started taping about the VH1 documentary, which is what got me into Warren Zevon. It wasn't Werewolves of London. It wasn't anything like that. It was that documentary. And so it did what he had hoped. It reached a younger audience. It reached an audience who wanted to dig into Warren Zevon and see his story a little bit better. And that worked on me, and I believe it worked on you. But from there, I just was able to unravel the story of Warren Zevon. And then later on in life here with my addictions and different things that I've gone through with now being 1 year sober, I get to understand his music in a whole different way. And my question really is to you, what is it about Warren Zevon for you? You mentioned earlier about your family having these records that they had kind of given to you, and that was your first exposure. But what is it for you? And what was it before you read this book, or when before you had seen that documentary? What in it about Warren Zevon does it for you?
I'm a little biased, so I could give you a plenty of answers, but I'd say it comes down to three things, maybe. Part of it is nostalgia. You know, I was exposed to his music very young, and so it'll always have a special place on my rotation. But I think musically, I think it's his ability to apply like such cynical, badass storytelling poetry to amazing music. And I think that's, again, I mentioned Lou Reed. He just has a very similar vibe in terms of being able to create that type of music, which is one of my personal favorites. And then the third part of it is, as we've kind of touched on this, is it really was his reaction to the cancer, which was, I'm not going to let this affect me negatively. I'm going to let this be a catalyst for doing the best creation that I possibly can. His relationship with death, he wrote about it his entire life, so he's obviously very cognizant of his own mortality, and he lived that way throughout his entire life.
Right, it's almost kind of like the stoicism in that is, okay, what time do I have to go? Do I have time to write a couple more songs here? Like, you know, it wasn't about going in some exotic location. It was like, let me do the work that I want to do, and then when my time's up, my time's up.
But also, his songs are just fucking great. Like, that could be my answer as well. he has some of the best fucking songs out there. And again, you know, not everybody knows them. I'm sure there are plenty of people who are not familiar with much of his music besides Werewolves in London. And we definitely would recommend checking him out. We've actually created a Remainders podcast playlist recommended by us of a collection of his best songs that we definitely like the best, and so we'll probably link that up to in show notes and whatnot and give you access to that, and you could definitely recommend checking them out.
Yeah, I've been enjoying that playlist throughout this whole reading. Man, you were right. Pat had texted me about, man, this playlist that I put together, I've been listening to while I've been reading the book, and I recommend that highly. It has been such a fruitful, giving experience to read this book and to listen to the music again of Zevon and to sort of rediscover him in some ways for me now that I'm older and I've gone through a few more experiences in my life that I could kind of understand. Some artists you need to spend some time with, you know, to really understand the great ones, I should say, to truly understand what they're giving you. And Warren Zevon certainly in 56 years gave a lot of himself, and I'm hopeful that with this book and, you know, what we're doing here in our small way, that his legacy will continue to grow till the end of the time, because I think he's a very important artist that had some great things to say, and in a very helpful way, whether he would have admitted that or not.
No, he would not have. Yeah.
And I promise you, for whatever it's worth, if I ever find a book that was owned by Warren Zevon, I will buy it for you immediately, no matter the cost, because you are certainly the person who deserves to own one of those.
Hell,
that
yeah.
Would be a great, great thing for you to have.
Well, now you got me all excited for that.
Closing out here, what a beautiful life. Thank you, Warren Zevon, for all you've done. And we miss you down here on Earth, but plenty of more darkness for me to write songs about, so I'll try to do my best to forge a way in your stead.
I definitely believe his music is going to live on for some time now, so he's not going anywhere anytime soon.
That's right. And thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Remainders on Warren Zevon and this book, Nothing's Bad Luck, which you should check out immediately. We hope you have a good night, and as always, thanks for listening. You have been listening to Remainders. This episode was written, narrated, and produced by Darren Burrell and Patrick McIntyre. Original music, episode art, logo, and editing by Darren Burrell. Find out what else remains by visiting our website at remainderspod.com. And we're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Just search at Remainders Pod. Please tell anyone you can about our show, and we look forward to telling you more of what remains next time.